Welcome to the second day of Long Beach Expo. My name is Michelle Brittany, and I am a freelance writer for Bleeding Cool, but also Fanboy Comics. And I'm also an editor for academic anthologies that analyze pop culture. And I have the privilege to moderate this panel this afternoon. It's called An Intimate Look at Writing Styles of Successful Comics Writers.
And me.
Which is part of the Make Comics series that's hosted by our comic book expo today.
It's the intimate part that I'm worried about, to be honest.
Well, we're going to turn the lights out.
Right? Yeah, exactly. We're going to dim the lights a little bit. Get some music going.
Yes. And I'll pull out the candles.
Right, put the clothing in the middle of the room.
Yeah. Some rose petals.
So just a quick kind of gauge of the audience.
That's right.
How many of you, raise hands, are writers or want to be writers?
Everybody.
Raise them up. All right, good. Okay. So you probably know that writing is a personal journey. That you'll often experience the exhilaration when words come together, which are often interspersed with feelings of profound defeat when a blank page stares back at you. So every writer has a different process for pulling words from within their mind and their heart and coming up with stories that we as readers get to eventually read and enjoy. So today, I'm joined by four phenomenal writers in the comic book industry. So we have Frank, Jimmy, Josh, and James, and they're here. They're going to tell us about their writing process for producing the best possible scripts, and perhaps they'll share a few pearls of wisdom and nuggets of information with us so that we can help develop our own writing processes and find our own successes. So I'm going to start out the panel with introductions, but probably a few questions of my own, but please, at any time, don't feel bashful. This is your time to ask questions. These are great resources up here to help you and to tell us what they're doing to be successful. So to get started, let's have some introductions. And Frank, if you'd like to start it off.
I'm Frank Thierry. I am a successful comic book writer. I've done a lot of work for Marvel, DC, Dynamite, Top Cow, I mean, just about everybody. Written video games, animation. I've been doing this since about 2000, and they still let me do it. So,
I'm Jimmy Palmiotti. I currently write Harley Quinn and Starfire with my wife, Amanda Khanna. Been in the business for 20-something years, and still enjoying it. It's still exciting and challenging, and I've also done work in film, TV, and a lot of video games and stuff like that, but it's all comes down to writing, so thank you.
I'm Josh Dysart. I'm currently part of the Valiant relaunch, and I've been doing that since 2011, but I've also worked for DC, Vertigo, Dark Horse, pretty much everybody but Marvel, and for reasons that are beyond me, honestly, I don't know how to...
They don't deserve you.
Fantastic.
Yes.
That changes everything. And that's who I am.
I'm James Kynan IV. I currently am writing Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for DC, and I've been the showrunner of the last two weekly Batman series, Batman Eternal and Batman and Robin Eternal for DC. I also do a lot of work with Boom Studios. I think I'm the baby up here. I've only been working for the last 5 years about, but I'm very excited to be here.
Well, welcome. So let's kind of jump right in. Can you explain at what point you decided that you wanted to be a writer, or what kind of catalyst that kind of drove you in that direction?
Sure.
I got to start again?
Yeah.
That's all right. I got to sit here.
You sit next to me.
Yeah, exactly.
So you get to go first.
Let's see. When did I want to be a writer? I actually, Jimmy knows, I was a editor at Marvel first. I interned at Marvel, then I... started working for Marvel.com, and so I didn't necessarily think I was going to be a comic book writer. It kind of happened. I was pitching while I was on staff, and eventually they were crazy enough to let me co-write Iron Man with Joe Quesada, and then I got Wolverine from there, and then I went freelance from that. But you know, it's funny because I was an art major, so you know. And I was an English minor. So it's the strange thing is you never know what tomorrow takes you. You never know, you know. It's just, don't limit yourself when you think about things. Think because, like I said, you don't know what tomorrow brings.
I love having Frank next to me because my Brooklyn accent is completely gone almost.
He sounds like Shakespeare next to me.
Right. When I'm the only one on the panel, I sound really good. But when Frank's there, I feel like, all right, maybe I've gotten
out of
this.
You sound like Neanderthal.
I moved out of the borough in time.
How you became a writer.
That's how I became a writer. I keep Frank next to me.
I think you're writing a little bit like
yes,
Paris.
No, but... when I started in comics, I started as an artist. So I was an inker. I was an assistant to a lot of other artists. And then in the mid-90s, Joe Quesada and I formed a company called Event Comics where we had to actually write our own books. And that was an interesting, it was like earn while you learn kind of experience. As a matter of fact, we used to ask people to write the intros to our books and they always would be sort of like a paragraph or two saying, "These books aren't very good, but they're really nice guys." And that went on for a while.
All spirit, no craft.
Yeah, it's pretty much. Yeah, it's like it's all energy, but you don't really want to read this stuff. And then part of that is, and then with Marvel Knights, when Joe and I started Marvel Knights, we started editing other people's work. And a lot that happens during that process is you start reading other people's work and you start correcting it, or you say, you know what, wouldn't it be better if we went that way? And that builds up your confidence to write something of your own. And I was inking like full time, big time at the time, and editing. And I literally got one job, came in the mail to ink, and it was horrible. And it had a note from the editor that said, "Can you please fix this?" And it was 22 pages of pencils that were horrible. Wow. And I wrote back a letter that said, "No." And I put it back in the FedEx envelope and sent it back. And I told DC, I said, "No, I'm not inking anymore as of today. So I'm done inking. I'm going to try to get writing work." So it was a decision I made. It came from a lot of, like anything in life, you have to have confidence in yourself. And it came for me, it came from a place where I sort of felt like I can do this. Did I believe I can do it? No, not until they started hiring me. But I still went in there saying, "Okay, I'm gonna try to make this work," and it's been working ever since.
I don't really remember a time when I didn't write. I had to have, since this is an intimate look at Arla, I had to
turn down the lights a little
bit. Yeah, exactly. Here we go.
Take your pants.
Are you ready? a woman named Ann Nickerson taught me how to read and write pretty late in my life because of certain cognitive whatevers. And she made me keep a journal, and ever since then, all my life, I've written extensively. I never expected to write comics, and I wrote super narcissistic, crappy shit for a long time.
That's my favorite title, but if you put that out, I would buy that. Would you buy that?
And it wasn't until 1996 when a friend like kind of talked me into writing a comic for her and her husband to make, and it got out in the world, that I saw how poor my writing was. So something really beautiful happened in that moment when you see your work through other people's eyes, when you're like exposed to the world. And that's when I really started to buckle down and try to figure out how to become a writer instead of just doing it automatically. And I think that's why they always say, like, to musicians or DJs or whatever, like, get in front of people and do what you do as soon as possible, no matter how bad you are, because it will change your whole approach to your craft. And that's what happened to me in 96, and I've just been trying to work out how to make a decent comic book ever since.
So I was, I don't remember really a time that I didn't want to write. And going back to middle school, high school, I had binders full of just story ideas, but I was never very good at taking those and actually making anything out of them. I would build entire worlds, and then it was like, okay, done, and I never actually started page one. But it was towards the end of that I really decided to start pursuing it more intensively. I did some writer's workshops in college writer's workshops while I was still in high school, and then ended up going to Sarah Lawrence College specifically for their creative writing program. While I was there, I met a young short story writer named Scott Snyder, and I became his writing assistant before he actually had ever published a comic. And our relationship really got going when he sent me the pitch to American Vampire in its very nascent form, and rather than just be like, oh man, this is awesome, I send him a 10-page critique of it. And then ever since then, Scott and I have pretty much talked story every single day. So it was a lot of the learning through Scott, learning how to shift from prose into comics, kind of like it. I was sort of seeing how he was adapting into the form and how he was experimenting with it, and at the same time, I was experimenting with my own work. I did a number of like small web comics that nobody has ever heard of because I scrubbed them all from existence when I started doing comics professionally.
Alter the record.
Oh yeah. someday they might come back out of there, but they were
I'm
just.
I'm gonna find them.
There's okay. Somewhere. Right. Yeah. You can't scrub shit.
We're fine.
There's a Wayback Machine.
Oh yeah.
That's right.
You guys know that, right? You can go way back. And, yeah, find it.
Everybody start looking that up now.
but yeah. So I got started. I was also in Internet Vertigo, and ultimately my first published comic was Batman number the backup story of Batman number 8 with which I co-wrote with Scott, and that's really where everything got started. And I'm like still amazed that I get to do this for a living, but comics were always the end goal, but I didn't think it was possible to like I never thought I'd be able to jump right in and do it, and like, and a lot of it's been learning on my feet, but I'm very happy with where I am now and where I want to be 10 years down the line. So yeah, it's always, you never stop learning.
Yep. So much of that is like sussing out your craft in public, right?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Yeah it's really, yeah, it's embarrassing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think I figured out, I think around Talon number 3, I figured out how to pace a 20-page comic, and that, like, but
and then
it was
you
definitely
scrubbed all the talons.
Oh, yeah,
exactly.
Just burned them. You can't find
I
those.
I still have a copy.
I still have that.
No, I have number one, Talon number 1. Yeah.
So once you got started down that road, James, you talked about you were actually doing classes and things like that, and for others of you, you were already in the business. But once you got going, how did you hone your craft? How did you, you know?
I mean, just writing every day.
Go with it. Run with it.
A lot of it's like Josh was saying, it's learning on your feet. It's really. You see what you put out there, and it's just like that didn't work. And you read so many comics, I was reading them plenty before being in the industry, but especially right when I got started, I just read everything I could and went back to the runs that I read in when I was a kid and in high school that spoke to me the most, because it was just like, okay, how did they do that? How did they create a world that I was just like incredibly invested in every single page of it, and what am I not doing that book did, and how can I hit those notes, but not in the way they did it, in the way I would do it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I for me, it was when Justin and I took on Jonah Hex, the first series, we did 70 issues, when most of them were done in ones, you know?
Great series.
And thank you. And what awesome. They teach you is, what they teach you is, you can tell a story in 22 pages, but you have to be smart, really smart, and things can't be excessive. You got to cut away the fat and get right to the story, and then save yourself for the moments, save yourself for the payoff moments. And so it's comic books. I think everybody in the room has an idea of pacing in a way. When you go to the movies and you know the ending's coming, you feel it like this. That big explosion is the third act, and now it's going to be. And they're either going to go up in the sunset, or they're going to walk and be clever with each other and walk into. So we have this natural thing with pacing that, you know, I always thought when I first started, I'm like, how am I going to know when I'm ending this?
Right.
So, and then we have it now with page count, and it's and I think, like I said, I think a lot of writing is instinctual.
Mm-hmm.
I think you approach a story, and you see what's working and not working, and you have to be critical on yourself, and editing is my favorite tool. I go back and finish a book, and I change, I take a shower, or I'll go for a bike ride, and I'll come back, and I'm like, oh.
Yeah,
I got to get rid of that whole middle section. Yeah, I just blew it there, and I go back and rework it.
And you have to have the courage to like scoop it out.
Yep, and say that doesn't work, and I got to restart. I think also too, you know, what happens is after a while you get a feel for, you know what, you know that. All right, I need about 4 pages of fight scene. I know this page. This is going to take about 2 pages. You know, you get a feel for it after a while. You know, of, like you said, with pacing and stuff like that. It's something, you know, the more you do, the more you...
Yeah. It's hard to make it... Once you start to fall into that, you don't want it to be visible, like mechanical. Mm, people are like, oh, here's my four pages of fight.
No.
And so you learn how to like submerge it and smooth out the transitions. Right. And what you were talking about, I really feel like, and I don't do this successfully at all, so, but I do recommend it, is have a right, you know, my what I've the writer's mind and the editor's mind, and the writer's mind loves everything you're doing. It's like, you know, I wish I could have a switch in my brain.
Yeah.
And it just loves it, and you're so into it, and you never, you know, you don't stop, and it flows right out, and then the editor's mind is where you just hate everything, and you eviscerate it and rearrange it and scoop it out. And if you can work hard to create like a separation between those two processes, I think it goes a long way. And like,
it's definitely about connection. It's connection, because yeah, you can write, go and keep writing and writing. But if the audience isn't connecting to the character, you really have to stop and say, what am I doing wrong?
Right.
Yeah.
Because I need a character moment here.
Yeah, because there are some difficult characters, and they're not really. I'll use an example of Harley Quinn. When they offered it to Amanda and I, you know, the first instinct I said is, we need to get her out of Gotham, and I want to create a new cast and a new life for her. Mm-hmm. And they were like, why? I mean, we've established, and I said, because she's in a relationship with Joker, I can't do that every issue. Yeah. I can't do this back and forth. I can't do it. If I give her a new setting and new characters, then we can all get to know the character out of the gate, how she thinks from day one. And without the Joker's influence always over her, and otherwise the character's gonna die.
Right.
And then we got lucky; it worked.
Yeah.
And then that's the other part of you, luck.
Oh, yeah.
Luck helps. Luck is a big part of it, but but it's an experiment always. And I've had so many failed series. Most successful people I think have so many failed series.
Yep.
I've done so many books that nobody's bored or it sucked. I even looked at it and I go, I don't want to look at that.
Yeah.
But people go, this is my favorite thing. This is my favorite book.
Yeah,
and you go, no, it's not.
Yeah. Pick anything but that.
Right. No, it's not. Yeah. It's not your favorite.
Exactly. That shouldn't be your favorite.
But it's about the connection, because then when something works, you amazingly at a show like this, you see people that connected with something, and you realize that you hit on something, and we don't even know it until afterwards. Sometimes it's like they come up to us and say, this has really changed the way I think about stuff, and I'm like, well, great, because I don't know, I had to get it done by Thursday.
I
just like, all
it
right.
wasn't done, it was due.
But a lot of it is instinctual. I think it is instinctual storytelling. It's the idea that this is interesting to me, and again, you write for yourselves. I'm sorry, but everybody says you write for yourself. If you're satisfied with it, then you have to look at it as the audience looks at it.
Yeah.
But I think you have to, yourself first. If I can make myself laugh on something, and I thank God I have Amanda upstairs, I run upstairs, is this funny? And she starts laughing. I'm like, okay, but you laugh at everything, so maybe I have to get somebody else, you know. But that's important as well, you know.
Rambling's important.
Rambling's
part of the
process. My book is all about rambling.
Yeah.
It's good. So why don't we kind of like dig into your actual writing process? You know, what does that look like? Is it every day? Is it the same hours every day? Is it, you know, Metallica blared at, you know, 20 or, you know?
I have family and kids and stuff like that, and pain in the ass friends, so it's not easy for me to work during the day. I do most of my work at night when everybody's sleeping, you know. And part of the process, honestly, it's a variation of something Jimmy actually taught me. Jimmy and Joe used to use, remember, cue cards?
Yeah.
Right. They used to use cue cards and say, okay, you know, and break things down with that. I do something similar. I go 1 to 20, you know what I mean? And I say, okay, on this page, each page, this is gonna happen on page one. This is gonna happen on page two, and then from there, once you get that, then I start breaking it down into panels. It's like, you know, it's all about keep breaking things down, breaking it down. You know, but yeah, it's as far as you know. When you have, I don't have like an office or anything where I can work in, so you work here and there, and as it comes.
You work on your stoop.
I work on my stoop. Yeah,
nice. That sounds lovely.
Yeah,
I work on my stoop.
It's a Brooklyn thing.
Yeah.
You have a stoop.
Yeah.
You work on your stoop.
Do you feel fresh? I mean, if you go through your day, spend time with your family, and do you still feel fresh at night?
No. Sometimes I do get to some work done during the day. I mean, it's not, you know, but there.
Whenever you can.
It's not as easy when you got, you know.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. I wake up really early. I sometimes front load before I go to sleep. I'm thinking about the book, and I wake up with an answer. Whether the dreams are helping or not, I have no idea, but I wake up with the answer. But I work really early, so I'll wake up like 6:30 and get to work by like 7, and I'll work till around noon. That's about when Amanda gets up, because she's a late night person.
Yeah.
And then I'm mentally tired, and I do something physical. So if I want lunch, I'll make sure wherever I'm going to go eat is probably 5 or 6 or up to 10 miles away, and I bike over there.
Nice.
And while I'm biking, it clears my head. Yeah. I go and eat. I bike on the way back. I'm thinking about it. Then I can't wait to get back because I've been thinking about whatever. And it's not always about blocks. It's just about cleaning the slate a little bit and getting back to work.
Yeah.
But I do most of my work early in the morning. And it's frustrating in our house because Amanda does most of her work in the night. And we keep trying to kind of push an hour. I say, you go an hour early sleep. You know, I'll wake up an hour later or whatever. You know, we're trying to do that all the time. But we're in different schedules. But I also take a nap. I know it sounds very old man-ish, but I take
a nap. You have to take a nap in the afternoon.
I do. At around like 2 o'clock, if I come back, I'll take a nap for like 20 minutes. And that's where I do a lot of my work. I'm laying, I have a favorite spot on the couch, I put on some classical music, and I Sherlock Holmes it a little bit. You
nice.
Know, I kind of get into my own head, and then I go back to work. It's just a recharge. It's a recharge thing. You know, I don't have the kids, and I don't have the idiot friends, except, you know.
I'm not your friend.
And not your friend. Yes, that's true now. But you definitely, I mean, you know, you find out what works for you. I don't know if there's a, you know, everybody has a different pacing, you know.
I go for walks, like, sometimes to think. You know, sometimes, like you said, you got to just clear your head. You just got to get up from the computer and say, and just think. I have to sit with a story for a couple of days. I can't just go down and just start typing automatically. You know, I have to get it worked out in my head. Like he says, sometimes you just want to, you can't just sit there, you know, go for a walk. Go, you know, go to the gym, whatever, you know?
Yeah, typing's not writing.
Yes,
yeah, that's
exactly.
Right.
That's
okay,
exactly.
So, yeah.
So I recently moved in with a lovely, lovely woman, but we live in a one bedroom and it's tough, you know. It's like the space is tough, and
she don't go to work?
She works 3 days a week.
Okay.
Now in fairness, they're like 14-hour days, but it's still only 3 days a week from my point of view. So
get a job.
Yeah.
Get a better job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I just recently started to like needing to kind of leave the house, and it's been really interesting because it's new for me. So I wake up about 7:30. By 8, I'm on my bike, and I have this. I found this place a couple of miles away, and it's actually kind of nice. Like, I have a little commute in my day, and I get some oxygen and get some exercise early on. And then I get there, and then I have, like, just a big stimulant, coffee, and
so you go to Starbucks and all that.
Basically, I mean,
just complaining about that the other day.
I never wanted to be those guys. I am one of those guys.
Well, at least you have a coffee.
Yeah, at least you have a coffee.
Yeah,
we were out in LA in Burbank, and we had 4 of us, and we're looking for a table, and there's 2 tables for 4 people. And there's. On each table, there's one guy, and his bag's on one chair, his motorcycle helmet's on another,
I hate
and
those
he has
guys.
No coffee.
Yeah.
And I just stood over him like this. I'm standing over him like, really?
Yeah.
Really, dude?
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, so fortunately, I don't go to Starbucks. I have this like big cafe with a little tiny table in a corner that nobody saw. I'm not hopefully not co-opting any space. But I'll do 4 to 6 hours there and get up and walk around and eat and go outside and then I'll go out for a bike ride. I'll take my bike around. I live in Venice Beach, so it's awesome to ride up and down the coast. And then I can probably pull another 2 hours of riding out of that, which is usually me cleaning stuff up or something. It's not very ambitious.
She's messy.
She's messy. Yeah, she is messy. I meant cleaning the story.
Oh, the story. I thought you clean up the house.
Like, I appreciate it. Yeah,
she has no job, and she doesn't clean
That'd
the house.
That'd be amazing if I cleaned the house. Like, improve
job,
the quality of our relationship.
No, but Jesus. Nope. You sure you want to still be with her?
Yeah. So that's kind of my day. And then my process is I start with like a vomit pass where I just like type out all my ideas. I try to do what I was talking about earlier where I like try not to edit myself too much. And then it's a big clumsy document. And then it's like sculpting, like I've dragged the rock into the studio and now I got to find the story in this big lug of rock. And it actually kind of slows my process down, but it feels good for me, and that's sort of how I attack it.
So for me, I'm not a morning person. I've never been a morning person in my life. And so I'll wake up around, between 9 and 10, and then sort of the first few hours of the day are more administrative stuff. That's when I respond to emails from editors. Yeah. That's when, I'll hop on the phone and, I might talk some story out, but I'm not doing any actual, getting down into the writing. My active hours are more noon to six. Like, it's when I feel like I am the most up and active, and I feel like I do the best work. And I have my own office in my house, and I will go into it, sort of shut the door. I don't work well in like cafes or anything because I don't like lots of outside noises or anything. I don't really even listen to music unless I only listen to music if my roommates are around and they are making a lot of noise, then it's to sort of drown them out. But it's just I need to sort of focus on what I'm working on. So and in terms of process, I start with the generic breakdown of the issue, sort of like. It starts as just paragraphs. It's just, this is what happens in the flow of the issue. And at this point, I kind of have a general sense of what fits in an issue. But then I'll take that general paragraph flow and I'll break it down into, I'll break it down by page. And each of the page, and then that's where I sort of find out, oh, God, no, I don't have room for, this whole paragraph, now that's in the next issue. And then then there's that kind of restructuring there. But once I have that kind of general flow of the issue and I have that, and I feel pretty strongly about that, I do a very, I start with dialogue because that's that's where I really find the pacing of it. And I will basically no panel descriptions whatsoever. I will write through the dialogue because I know what's happening on every page. In my head, the panel descriptions are already there roughly, but I will just write cover to cover the dialogue for the issue scene by scene, and then I take that and I will break it down by panels and all that, and that's when I realize, okay, this has too much dialogue. How do I simplify this thought? How do I make this action beat much bigger? And yeah, in the one thing I'll say is I will, in the midst of a huge action sequence, I sort of, it switches, then the dialogue matters less and it's more, these are the beats of the fight, more generally. But then I smooth it out, and that, sort of the first draft that I come to at the end of it is sort of the third or fourth step in my process. And that's sort of the, that's when there's all the panel descriptions, everything's there on the page. The one thing, I definitely started out in more, because I would read the Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman scripts, which are very, dense with descriptions and all of that. And I sort of, especially as I started working with artists for longer periods of time, I realized, I kind of know the shorthand of what they're going to deliver, so I don't need to, if I have a very concrete idea, it's like, okay, I have a really cool idea how to set up this page and all of that, I might go more into descriptions, but I will describe more the setting at the top of the scene, and then, panel descriptions are more just, Batman and Gordon, and that's all you really need, unless there's, the emotion comes out of the scene, I don't know, that's really how I've sort of honed the process over time, and it took a while for me, I got to that point because when I was breaking it, this is the panel description, this is the dialogue in the panel, it took me ages, and the second I started switching over into the more pure dialogue flow, I became about three times as fast writing, and yeah, and I'm also not really a write every day person. I need the script kind of I figure everything out and then I write down that first breakdown and then I write it. It's there's a few days in every week that are just kind of my active work time is frankly just me sitting in my office kind of staring at a wall processing everything, or just I'll go for a walk or just pace around the house and people talk to me and I'm not processing whatever they're saying to me, but that's really how I do it.
You know, there is this kind of really unique thing about our medium where if you're not doing the art yourself and writing it, where once you've really worked with an artist over time, it will change the way you script.
Sure, of course.
And then it becomes frustrating when to get a new artist, even even if you get a genius.
You gotta relearn the whole.
Yeah, it's like it's like a relationship. Yep. You gotta figure out like what do they do well and what are they. So that really changes things a lot too.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, one more. I'm so sorry to talk to you. One more thing. The most important thing I do in my writing day is I have a program that turns the internet off for 4 hours. I highly recommend that.
I have no problem. I don't go
that's awesome.
I don't care. There's nothing there I really worry about.
Yeah, I'll research the shit out of something for no reason at all.
That's Amanda. Amanda says down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. It's so easy for me to fall down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Well, before I ask any more questions, are there questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
Family members from people on the panel that have been co-writers. Can you talk a little bit about a process with a co-writer or a collaborator that might be an artist or an editor?
We're co-writing right now.
Yeah, we're doing the Gang of Harleys
Gang
right
of
now.
Gang of Harleys, yeah.
I've written with other people, like, a lot. Mostly close friends, because it's fun. And it's challenging, and what happens is you argue, you find new ideas, and... But the basic layout is we work out the story together. So what's it going to be? What's this issue going to be about? We'll break it down, write it down to the point where we feel like here's all the beats. And then depending on how busy each person is, you hand it off or you do it yourself. And then it's like a tennis ball over the court. Boom, boom. You knock the script back until you're happy with it. I'm happy with it. Let me just tweak one thing. So that's how we did. It's what I did with Justin. It's what I did with Amanda. It's what I do with Frank. I enjoy doing it. It's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. I enjoy doing it because to me it's challenging and I learn a lot from watching other people.
Also,
write.
You have to put your ego aside.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to recognize
that's
better
right, Frank.
Wow.
Sorry, too easy.
Anyway.
Too easy. Way too easy. Way too easy.
If that's the way you feel.
if you guys have...
I'm going to edit that.
If you guys have like a conflict, do you decide early on like in the issue that one person is going to be the lead on this?
No.
You listen to the... if there's a conflict, it just means something's not working.
Yeah.
Right. Or the other person doesn't understand it.
Right. Yeah.
So you have a conversation.
Out. Yeah.
Because you had something, you say, why did this person get killed? And I'm explaining, well, because if we established this early... then it's the person's more dangerous, that we don't know when the next person's going to, so a lot of times it's not always obvious why somebody's doing something, and that's the part of the process of working with someone is you talk it out. It's relationship, right? It's any kind of relationship. Yeah. You know.
And sometimes that's even that part of the conversation is when you realize why you did that.
Yeah,
right.
You didn't until you actually say out loud of why I made this decision. It doesn't make, like, I've done a lot of different...
And that maybe you need to massage that decision to the surface or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, massage.
Massage that shit.
I don't like where this is going.
It's an intimate
my ego and, intimate, you know.
But there's a level of trust.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's every co-writing relationship is very different. Yeah. And every time I've co-written, it's been a very different process. Even like I've co-written a lot with Scott, but it's been a different process a lot of times. Like right when I first got started, it was much more we would talk it through, like, you know, infinitely before I sat down and actually wrote it, and then Scott was more like we would come up with the story together and then I would write it, and then Scott would be sort of the first round editor, and we would make sure everything was polished. There would be about draft 7 before it would actually go to the editor. That's where I really began. But then we just co-wrote Batman 49. And in that issue, it was still, like, Scott's the kind of guy, he talks through story. He doesn't, like, I brainstorm in a document, but Scott needs to talk it all out.
With everybody.
So, with everybody.
I know what's going on.
Yeah. So with that, we would, like, we talk through the beats and all of that, but it would just be like, okay, this scene plays I like writing like big sappy emotional scenes, and there's a few of those in 49, and Scott was like, okay, you're gonna take the lead on that, and I'm gonna take this, and then we sort of disappeared for a few hours and came back with another 10 pages of script. And then we sort of like, okay, that doesn't work, that does work, this needs to be expanded, that needs to be contracted, and we sort of talked it like every step of it through, and that was more the like a full-on back and forth. I'm also co-writing Constantine the Hellblazer right now with Ming Doyle, and that's something where we've come up with the whole story for the year and we know what happens in every single issue, so right before the issue we do a back and forth phone call where we sort of figure out what happens and we do the page breakdown, but then I write the first 10 pages, she writes the second 10 pages, and then we like edit each other and smooth out the gaps, and then it goes to the editor. So it's just, it's a very different process every single time.
Do you find that it increases the time it takes to write the script working with a co-writer, or decreases, or does it make no impact on how long it takes you guys to write a script?
It increases for me. It increases, yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's more communication
usually
time.
Usually we do issue by issue. Like, yeah. I'll do an issue, he'll do an issue. Yeah. I'll do, you know, and we'll, like, I'll write an issue, and then he'll go and screw with it, and then we'll,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I didn't mean it like that. Or did I?
Create a unified voice.
Or did I? Or vice versa. He'll write, you know, when he writes something, then I'll go in and do my thing, you know?
I think we had a question over this side. Do we have one over here?
No? No question?
Go ahead.
In terms of, like, format, like, I learned to write for film. Mm.
Right.
Like, how do you guys write to pick up to your artist the easiest way? You
know, right, we're not quite as, like, hemmed in as screenplay writers.
Yeah, we definitely, I mean, every script I look at, everybody's got a definite,
a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the what you should do is, there are comic scripts online, so check out what people do and maybe read it and see what is easiest for you. A lot of people get into the, like Justin, when I work with Justin will make this thing bold, make that thing lowercase, move that thing
totally
in,
do that.
This and that, and I'm just like...
It's like a tweaker mentality.
And I am like, I am so not that. I'm like, here's what's going on, here's the panel, here's what's going on, here's the dialogue, next panel.
Yeah,
because I don't care what it looks like in the end. I mean, I think Justin, I've always felt like he's going to print it out and present it
sell
to
it.
A king.
Yeah.
You know, afterwards, you know?
I'm so guilty of this.
It's too... delicate for me. I'm just like, I don't care about that. It's like, I'm worried about... So it comes down to your personal taste. There's nothing wrong unless it's hard to follow. Unless your format is crazy.
Or your clarity is the most
important. Yeah, exactly. We even change typefaces on certain things. And I'm like, stop that. Stop it. You know?
Well, you know, I made a template for myself about 15 years ago in some Word program that I have to constantly keep bringing over to a new Word program. And I've gotten to a point now, maybe Justin is in the same situation, where I have a hard time visualizing the page and how much space I have unless, like, my dialogue's at this font. And, like, I've really damaged myself.
Yeah. Oh, with Frank, you know, Frank has a different format.
Yes,
To me, it drives me insane because it's right in the middle.
Really?
And it's big, and like the pages. Yeah, it's like I can't follow it.
Yeah.
You know, so I asked him, I said,
Can you do it my way?
Can you do it my way?
That's what he says. Can you do it my way? I did. And he uses Amanda, you know, because Amanda doesn't get it. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, Amanda has a problem following that other format because she makes corrections on the type.
A lot of people use that
form. Uh-huh. A lot of people I don't know.
Well, anyway, you won. You got the format you wanted.
Yeah, it's cool.
What else you want? You want to embarrass me in front of everybody?
No. Look, in the end, though, it matters what I get. And that's all. That's what I'm trying
to
say.
You got your way in the end.
Of course I
did.
I don't care. I'm perfectly
fine.
Satisfied.
Then fine.
Okay, I know we have a question over here because I saw a hand go up. Yes.
So there's been kind of a trend in comics over the last 10 years for the dialogue and, you know, the beats of the story to be shown more on the art side of things.
Mm.
You know, especially going back to when I first started reading comics, like in the 80s, there was really, you know, dialogue heavy. Have you noticed, has it changed for you guys, like in your process, or are you conscious of that? It seems to be a little more decompressed
I'm
now.
Conscious of the price of a comic.
Yeah,
$4. And I feel that there should be something to read
there.
I'm not a big fan of something I could read in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest. Unless it's like Jim Stranko doing a whole silent scene or something. But a lot of times I feel cheated a little bit when I'm reading. And then I'm like, that's it. And also, you know, because they're expanding stories out that maybe hit a trade.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess, again, my pushback was that Jonah Hex series. Like, I'm gonna just tell the whole story in one issue. But I just think that we've become more conscious of that. I hope we have. Because there were a couple of, like, Marvel books were doing it for a while. There was Avengers books and stuff where people would just be a panel where each character would say one word.
Yeah.
And it's like 4 pages in, and I'm like, nobody moved. Like, I'm like, what's going on? But I was like, I just paid $4 for this.
Yeah.
It's sort of like I got a YouTube video instead of a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so I'm conscious of that because I buy comics.
Yeah.
You know, I spend my own money on them, so I feel like I need to have a story. And I'm not saying it's more type or more anything, it's just that. A movie, a story could be pushed better beat, you know, be pushed a little bit instead of the expanding
needs
thing.
Needs to be some substance there, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, like, I'm totally with Jimmy. Like, you'll get a comic and there'll be three panels per page and they'll be beautiful. And you're having such a positive peak experience with this comic for about 3.5 minutes. And then it's done, you know? And you're like, so I think part of your craft that you learn is how comfortable are you? How much density do you want? And it's funny because you were mentioning starting with dialogue. I actually write the visuals out first, but you would not know that because I'm such a wordy motherfucker. I struggle not to be so wordy. I don't know why I can't lick this.
Yeah.
But I do. But the one positive thing about it is I do feel like I'm a little too dense sometimes, and maybe I'm like doing the exact opposite of decompression where I'm like really pressing it all in.
Yeah.
But at least I'm giving you $3 worth. I'd like to maybe, you know, I'd like to find a nice middle ground. I've struggled a lot of my career to understand that, but at least I'm not giving you like a 3-minute read, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm still trying to find the right path.
I mean, what do you guys like? Do you like it like that? Do you like a quick read?
I mean,
read?
They're beautiful. They're so pretty when they're big and blown open like that. But
no, I mean, writers like to read.
That's right.
Okay,
yeah.
But I do have people go to me. We did this book Super Zero, and it's a lot to read. And a guy said, yeah, I gave it to my son, but he said it's too much to read.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, well, beat up your child because it's true. I mean, you know, don't let him get away with saying that. You know?
Yeah.
But you realize that that audience maybe wants to read something quick, you know, and maybe that's not the book for them, too. But
yeah, I mean, there's room for both styles, you could argue.
Yeah, sure.
Wrongly.
Scooby-Doo is a quick read, you know. It's kind of quick, right?
Yeah.
The guy wants the real estate, he got
right,
the sheets. Right, it's kind of a quick read. You don't really want to read a lot on Scooby-Doo unless it's Shaggy, like, you know, getting off in the back of a van or something.
But you know, if you have like a 150-page graphic novel, then you can really blow it out and it's really pretty.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, it's when we got 20 pages, 22 pages. Where
let's be honest, too, it depends on the artist.
Yeah, of course, absolutely.
I mean, I
watch Jeff Darrow do 3 panels a page all day long.
Right, and Jeff is the guy that draw a book with a guy with a sword running and chopping up lizards for 40 pages.
Yeah, the same.
And it's awesome.
Yeah, and it's awesome. Yeah,
I, you know,
but you don't want to have Alan Moore writing Scooby-Doo. Or SpongeBob. Alan Moore doing SpongeBob
would be amazing.
Of course, it would be amazing. But it wouldn't work so much, you know.
SpongeBob would find out he was a human and thought he was a sponge.
Right. There you go.
Well, we're getting down to about 5, maybe 10 minutes left,
okay.
So I want to get to a few more questions, sir, in the back.
Jimmy, your question about how much do you want to read brings up an interesting question as well. Because a lot of story can be told in the visuals, so how much do you tell your artist what's happening in this panel, especially like if there's a big story beat, but there's no dialogue?
I'll tell you, and this is the thing you'll learn as you do comics. How much do you trust your artist?
Yeah.
How good is your artist to get that across? Because if it's a weak artist, you have to write a little more.
Yeah.
If it's a really strong artist, I like to use an example, 100 Bullets.
Mm.
You know, when Brian writes that, there's a lot of quiet, simple pages. Eduardo is such a great artist, you're getting it, you know?
Yes.
And then sometimes it falls apart. Sometimes the art, all of a sudden you're stuck, you didn't realize it was going to, and you hope. They give you a lot of times. They give you a last pass, so they'll put the lettering with the art before it goes out, and you can start trimming it because you say, "All right, the art looks good."
I always get that.
So you can have that, or you can add because I've had to add because it wasn't clear.
Because the storytelling is.
Then I have to have a character say, "I'm opening the door now." You know, because the character's nowhere near the door, and it's supposed to be the character opening the door.
Yeah, it hurts my heart when I have to do that.
I know,
it's really hard,
especially now with language. Sometimes you know they don't speak English. And you have to over-explain, you know, make sure that they understand it.
Yes, it's good in your scripts to reference things. So
I did once, very quickly, to that point, I was working with the great Enrique Breccia, real honor, and, you know, older guy, and I wrote that this one character is, like, hovering over another character in their sleep, and what I meant was at their bedside leaning over. Mm. But he actually drew the figure floating above.
But you kept that, right?
I totally kept it.
Okay, because that's awesome. Cause that's awesome.
I know, man. We kept it, you know.
I'm really creative. I see things hovering.
Really, it worked out, but, you know, fine example of that.
I like that.
I have a question about long-term plotting. I'm wondering with, like, screenplays and novels, like, you finish your draft and you have the beginning and the end, and you can go back and you can work it all at once.
Yes.
When you're releasing something monthly, I'm
like, everything's a first draft, basically. I mean, how do you guys?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you turn a corner and there's something better.
Yeah.
And then you're like,
yeah.
Ooh, I got to change everything.
Yeah. Well,
especially you with the weeklies.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, like with the weeklies, and then also with the I do a series called The Woods, and I'm on issue 20 just came out in stores, and it's going to be a 36 issue story. And if I had stayed to the rigid plan I had when I was writing issue 2, it would be a drastically different story, because I just realized that there's a character wouldn't actually do what you set them out to do because you get to know them while you're writing them. And it's just like, okay, this is like wildly out of character. Now I have to reshift this around. And like, I killed off one of the main characters in my series in issue 12, which changed the entire remaining 24 issues of the story. And that made it more, more exciting. So, that's the fun of it is you do because it comes out so fast, because you do need to stay on your toes. You do need to be willing to kill your darlings and just and change the story to make the story the best thing it can be. It's a living beast, and it comes out in increments, and sometimes you'll make a misstep and you need to correct, or sometimes you make a misstep and it's just like, I'm gonna follow this misstep.
Right.
Sometimes you don't have a choice. It makes it to print. I mean, there's kind of a yin and a yang to it. We learn a skill set that people Charles Dickens had to write this way, because he was putting out little pamphlets at a time, one at a time, and we learn a skill set where sometimes we make a creative decision, we haven't sussed everything out down the line, and then that hits print, and okay, so now you're stuck with that creative decision, and you got to work with that, and that's an interesting skill set we get that someone like a novelist doesn't get, or a screenplay writer, but something really beautiful can come out of that too, where more often than not, you find out that you made you always had made the best decision, and something truly beautiful comes out of it that you couldn't. There's like a magic to it, and that's when you're like really involved in the creative process. And comics, for me, has illuminated that to me more than any other thing style I've tried to work in. Just because precisely, you have to commit to a creative decision early on, and you have to find a way to bring that home. And it's a really interesting exercise. Yeah.
So we have. I'm going to take one more question with you in just a moment. Okay. Before I do that, because we've got to wrap up pretty soon. Gentlemen, can you please tell everybody where you're at for the rest of the afternoon? I know some of you have tables.
Sure, yeah. We're on booth 1000.
Booth 1000.
When you walk in, right to the right. We're near food and ice cream.
Yeah. All right.
Come plan.
Made it plan
that
way.
No.
I'm at J10, and also, if I could pimp something very briefly, there's a free comic book you can read. In December 2014, I went to Iraq, and a comic about the stories I heard from the refugees is online. It's called Living Level 3. It's at Huffington Post. You can just zoom past all the side boob articles, and you'll find it there.
Why would I want to do that?
I mean, or not, or not.
I got a boob on my side.
And it's 35 pages. I'm really happy with it. It's free to read. Please check it out. Living Level 3. J10.
And I'm at table B2, so you can find me there.
Cool. And you guys are all on Facebook or Twitter or like that?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on the Twitter.
Do it.
Okay, and gentlemen, you were so patient. Go ahead.
Yeah, as an aspiring writer and artist, what would it take to get a character like Gladiator of the Imperial Guard to have his own comic book, like to carry a title, or to get Gladiator and the Imperial Guard? They made their appearance in the X-Men comics.
So you want to approach the company and say, hey, I want to do Gladiator and the Imperial Guard as a book? Is that what you're talking about? Well,
or just Gladiator self-touched, just by himself.
Sure, but you want to approach the company and say, I want to write this? Is that what you want to do?
Yeah.
Okay, well, a lot of times they look for you, okay? So it's hard to kind of just put that out there, because they, if you understand the job of an editor, the editor is to get the book out and make his life as easy as possible. So an editor will hire people that he trusts or knows that he can just give the job to and not worry about. Yeah. That's his job, is to be, not lazy, but I'll just say move a book through as quick as it can.
It's our job.
You have a choice of you have to get on the editor's radar at that point. The editor has to say, oh, look, I like this guy's writing. Maybe I'll hire him, and then he'll ask you the question, what would you like to write? And you say, I'm so glad you asked, because blah, blah, blah. All right, but the chance of that happening means that you have to go out and actually establish yourself or have some work done, especially if it's Marvel or DC. They're going to make sure, they're going to want to know your indie work. They're going to read other books you've written so they can say, you know, they can see that you could pay something. And there is lies the, you know, the problem that always comes up. How do I get my first work out there? Well, the great part is we have the internet. You can write stories. You can create a website. You can link and social media your stories to other people. You can find people interest groups that are interested in parts of your story or things in your story and reach out to them and say, hey, would you love to read my story? So on and so forth. So social media is a huge thing to get out. But at the end of the day, you still just have to work and put it up there and get it out. If you back your own comic, if you Kickstarter, if you, you know, shake down everyone in your street and put out your own book, and you know, whatever it may be, like Frank. And
But just clipping people at the knees.
Yeah,
in my comic.
But honestly, you have to get on their radar. They're not going to just hire you because they like you,
right?
Or something. Those days are over.
No, yeah, that's,
you know, or you're a cousin of somebody. You know,
well, that might still work.
That might still work. It's Stanley's
cousin. So I think what Jimmy's saying is like, and I absolutely is that you can't just roll in. Like, I understand if that's your intention, but you're gonna have to like produce some work on your own. You know, do some time in the trenches before the editor can see you, see what you have to offer, and let you in, and it takes a while.
When I was a kid, I liked the book Daughters of the Dragon, when it was the 70s, like when I was a kid, and I said, one day I want to write this book, and it took me like 34 years to get to write that book, and I finally did.
Tenacity is the...
They're not going to let you walking off the street.
No, but you got to work. You got to do your work and get it out there. Show people what you can do.
Yeah, and at the same time, you have a tool. Well, you said you kind of just broke in like 5 years ago, which is awesome. But you have a tool that we really didn't have, which is the internet. Like I had to like print my books, and I had to like lug them from convention to convention. And you guys have this amazing distribution tool. It also means that the barrier to entry is lower, so there's a lot of stuff out there that you're competing against. But, you know, use that tool. That's an amazing tool. I wish I had had that when I was breaking in.
Yeah, I would suggest everyone read about working your work on social media. It's really important. Just read these articles about how to get your name out there, and then have the work somewhere where you can link it. Link people to your work. Let them get to like it. Look, you can go on Amazon and for 99 cents write a chapter of a book and put it up on Amazon and have people buy it. There's a Hugh Howey did a book called Wool that he put up every month, and he did a chapter, and he sold over 2 million copies plus, and it's a movie, you know, it's a movie coming. This is a guy that wrote it. He worked on a boat, and he would write these chapters and put them on Amazon, and people started picking them up. Nobody knew who he was.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
On that note, let's thank our guests.